Hello. When Jim asked me if I'd like to talk, and I said yes, I asked him for help in deciding what to talk about. And he said, well, you could talk about your father. I guess I had been speaking about my father, who was recently dead. And when Jim said I could speak about my father, I thought, yeah, I'll speak about death. Right. He said, father, I thought, father, dead father, or death. And because the relationship that I have with my father, or had, was quite special. We were very, very close. He was 19 years older than I am. So he's quite young when I was born. And he was always this great presence in my life. And since his death, I have often found myself thinking about and recognizing a gesture as being his gesture. Or I look in the mirror and I see my father's visage. I look similar to my father. I think I inherited his sense of humor. I tell stories in the same way he did. And of course, I carry his DNA, so we share materiality, right? Just a real profound effect on my life. When he died, well, let me back up and talk a little bit more about him, perhaps. But first, I want to say that I practice Zen in the Kwannon school lineage, which is Korean Choge, and although I'm the abbot of this small sitting group, an abbot in our tradition is not quite the same as in the Soto tradition. The abbot is more like a caretaker. He takes the money, or makes sure that there are cushions, cares for the temple, just takes care of the business side of things. He's not really necessarily a spiritual teacher. Also, the brown ruksu is in keeping with the tradition. It's not, and I know in the Soto tradition, those who have received transmission and to teach wear a brown ruksu. In the Kwannon school, in the single flower school, it's just what you are given when you take the precepts, 16 bodhisattva vows or precepts. And for me, the practice has always been, I keep reducing it to its simplest terms. I loved something I read a long time ago by, I think his name was Olensky. He's a scholar at the Bari Buddhist Center, where the Insight Meditation Institute is located. And he said that the Buddha wrote this or composed this amazing poem that goes Dukkham Samudayo Nirodha Magga, which he translated as feeling stress, let go, here's how. Yeah. And that's pretty much the practice of Buddhism for me, including the practice of Zen. And I also recognize that the great value in my life to practicing has been developing equanimity. And this equanimity is far-reaching, I guess. It's pretty profound. My father showed equanimity when he was in his final weeks. He demonstrated equanimity. Could do you know where my bag is? Jeff, could you get it? There's something I wanted to show. I forgot to bring it up here. It's down in the little cubbyhole back in there, gray bag. Thank you. My father said he'd had a good life. He had good children. He had a good job. Not a great life, he said, but a good life. Thank you. And he was ready to die. He knew he was going to die before he received his diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. He called me before he went in to receive his diagnosis and asked me to travel to New Mexico, to Las Cruces, New Mexico, where he lives, so I could be present with him when he saw his oncologist. Because he said his wife, my stepmother, was going to take it very, very hard, and he knew that the diagnosis was going to be terminal. And it was. And we received the diagnosis on June 16th, and he died on August 18th. I stayed out there with him and my stepmother for a few weeks. My father had just finished writing a book about his father, and he wanted to see it published. So he asked me to help him, and I have those kinds of skills. So I took his manuscript and photos that he had of his family and his father, and I laid out a book and published it on Amazon, and then sent him a bunch of copies of it, and he distributed them to friends and family. And he called it Homer, My Father's Odyssey. His father was named Homer. My father is named Thomas Edison Work. I'm John Thomas, which you know. But he was named Thomas Edison because his father, my grandfather, was close to Thomas Edison for a period of time and drove for Edison and George Firestone and who else was there? Oh, and Edison, right? Edison, Firestone, Ford, and would go on these epic trips into the mountains in caravans, and my grandfather drove once or twice for them, and when they went up into the mountains to go camping. And we got a string of Christmas tree lights made by Edison that were in the family for a long time, and then disappeared during the move from Iowa to Detroit. My grandfather was also a Lincoln scholar, so my dad had lots of stories about Lincoln. Right? I have a great-great uncle who was a newspaper reporter who was present for the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and the reporters would actually act like court reporters almost. They'd write down every word that was said and then rush back and print these in the newspaper, and then they go out all around the country. And it's his great-great uncle, Height, was his name. Oh, did it go somewhere? Okay, thank you. How's that? Okay. So, he had stories about Height, who was at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and the story is that Lincoln was there, Douglas was there, and hundreds of thousands of people were waiting in the hot sun, but they couldn't begin until the journalist arrived, Height, so he could record the proceedings. And I think it was Lincoln who said, we can't start because Height ain't here yet. And then when he arrived, Lincoln cut off a lock of his hair, which was frequently done in those days by people, and gave it to my great-great-uncle as to memorialize the day. And my father ended up giving that and some other Lincoln memorabilia to Lincoln University in Tennessee, where my father was also present for my grandfather's receiving a degree, an honorary degree, on the same stage as Carl Sandburg. You know, and my father, who was, as a 10-year-old, remembers being bounced on the great poet's knee on the stage, and then being given a book by Sandburg. And all these memories of my father had were really important to him, and they were in this book. My father's mother died when he was 15, and his father moved away from Iowa, where my dad was living then, and my dad stayed behind and finished high school and met my mother, and then we all moved away from Clinton, Iowa in 1963, the year that Kennedy was shot. And years and years later, I was working in New York City, and my father had a brother that he'd lost track of for decades, who I found living in New York City, not far from where I was working at a newspaper. I answered the phone one day and had this conversation with a pleasant woman who asked me to repeat my name. I'd introduced myself when she first called. And she said, "I know a Bob Work. I wonder if you're any relation." And it turned out to be my father's brother. Each of my father's siblings had a different mother. They talked when they got together about all this great stuff that their father had amassed over a lifetime that had disappeared. And they last recall seeing it in Clinton, Iowa, and they thought maybe it was left behind in a warehouse and had since disappeared. And this was like 30 years, 25 years then, 30 years. And I thought, well, there's a chance the stuff is still there, or maybe I could find the warehouse. So I made calls to Clinton, found there were two warehouses, and one of the warehouses said they had Homer Work's boxes on a pallet in the back corner. You know, so it's like 30 years later. So I told my uncle, who had just reacquainted himself with my father, and he immediately got in his big Suburban and drove to Clinton and reclaimed his father's belongings. There were pictures and photographs. There were scientific discoveries. This guy was kind of a Renaissance man. So there are all these great stories that my father remembered, and he wanted to share them with his family. And he asked me to put together this book, so I did, Homer, My Father's Odyssey. And this is a photograph of my father reading the book in the final weeks of his life. It took me, you know, 2 or 3 weeks out in New Mexico to put this book together. And at one point he said in exasperation, "God damn it, John, I'd like to see the book before I die." You know? He was quite happy with it. When Mio was here a week ago, he mentioned the Parinirvana of the Buddha. And in it, he said the Buddha goes through the jhana stages from the first stage up to the eighth, and then back to the first, and then up to the fourth, and then, you know, it passes away. He dies. And that jhana state, I think Mio said, is one of great equanimity and great freedom. And there's sort of this suggestion in Zen and in Buddhism generally that if we practice diligently, we will experience great peace and equanimity. And I think many people hope that that will be the case at the time of death. And I've thought a lot about death since my father's death, and was thinking about what Mio said. And I don't know what happens at death. The research I've done suggests that it's not a restful, peaceful time for most people. I think 30% of people in their final week of life report being in great pain, great suffering. And cancer patients, I think it's like 90%, you know. And we go through stages of dying. As I understand it, there is a sort of pre-active period that lasts for about 3 weeks, and then there's an active period of dying that lasts for about 3 days. And it's true for all of us. The at the time of death, again, it's the same for all of us, right? You have the body begins to lose its temperature. It's at a rate of 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit per hour. The blood in the body pools at the point of contact with gravity, whatever those lowest points of the body are. The body will turn purple where the blood pools within the body. The rest of the body will get very pale and white. The carbon dioxide builds up. Calcium builds up. Rigor mortis sets in, and within 12 hours, it's like at its peak. I didn't know this until I read it recently, but the rigor mortis subsides after about 48 hours. So the stiffness that occurs leaves. And the cells explode. Enzymes come out of the cells and when they explode, and the body digests itself. The organs digest themselves, you know. And before death, there are stages too, right? My father was really against using drugs. He didn't want to die in a state in which he lacked a clear mind. He wanted to be clear in his thoughts and feelings. He did have a lot of drugs at the end. Pancreatic cancer is incredibly painful, and he did agree to drugs at the end. And he did go into hospice in the final days. I was not invited to come back out to be with him and my stepmother at that time. A younger brother was asked to go out. He's taller than I am. My dad's like 6'1", 6'2", and my younger brother is as well. And I think my stepmother wanted him because he could be physically of greater help to her. I'm 5'9" or something. I'm not as tall or as big as my father. And when I was out there, it was difficult caring for him. At one point, he fell in the bathroom, and he was in such pain and such agony, he didn't want to be touched, and he didn't want to be helped, and I felt like I had to lift him up and get him back into the bed anyway, and he cried in great agony. And for all I know, it was that moment that he decided he didn't want me coming back. I don't know. It could also be that my stepmother didn't want my me there because of the practice of Buddhism. You know, my father was very supportive of Buddhism, and he liked the practice, and tried in his own way to practice, I think. But my stepmother is sort of adamantly opposed to anything that has the scent of religion on it at all. And she's fiercely independent and I think suffers quite a bit as a result, you know. But she's a lovely woman, and I care for her a lot. I'm sort of looking after her from afar since my father's death. My father, just about 5 days before his death, said through my stepmother to me on the phone, when I asked, "How are you doing?" That he had lost about an hour on his marathon time. So, yeah. And he still had his humor, but I think you begin to lose your coherency as you get closer to death. And He was a little bit more confused, and there were these metabolic changes going on in his body as a result of the cancer, which would have caused confusion and maybe some agitation. There's a condition that occurs called terminal restlessness, and some people will clutch at sheets and pull at things and, you know, seem to be very, very agitated. In my father's case, he kept trying to get up and move. And I think my stepmother and brother felt that he wanted to stay alive. He was struggling to stay alive. But who knows? I mean, there are these metabolic chemical changes and electrolytes and everything else that affect one's mind and consciousness. So it's not clear what was happening to him. Probably it was just the metabolic changes that were driving him to stand up and try and walk and get away from his own death. But that's the way we project onto the dying person. It's not necessarily what's happening. And I think the practice of meditation and the Dharma, I've come to appreciate, is not so that I have a good death in the sense that the death itself will be pain-free and I'll be at peace and at rest. The practice is to create the equanimity during life, like right now, right, during this moment. And that it's helpful to understand, for me to understand in that way, because I'm not looking now for a moment at death of great clarity, or I don't know what will happen, right? I may be heavily drugged. I may be in such pain and suffering so much that I can't, there's no thinking or consciousness. It may be, I don't know what the experience of death will be. I only know kind of what happens scientifically and medically when I die, and I know what the experts say happens during the stages of death. So I don't look to Buddhism to somehow magically help me avoid suffering at death. There may be great suffering. In fact, you know, I think the experts suggest that I have cancer, there's going to be suffering at death. And even if there's not, there's a 30%, 36% chance that there will be great pain and suffering in my final week. So this reflection on my father that has been going on, this sort of meditation on his death that's been, I've been engaged in now for many months, has led to this deeper appreciation of what the practice can do and kind of what it probably can't do, you know. But I also realized that this practice of non-duality, this, you know, of no separation of between me and Clem or me and Jeff or, you know, any of us, this room, this non-separation, that is such a wonderful practice that I've been practicing for a long time, this awareness of dependent arising, you know, all the conditions that come together to make a moment and just appreciating them. They kind of arise and they fall away. No moment lasts forever. It's something that arises in perception and thought and feeling. It lingers for a little while. It begins to decay and then it goes away and something else comes to replace it. That experience of no separation of self and other became something very different for me when I faced my father's death. Because there was separation. There was this other there, and then that other was gone. How do you practice with that? You know, that it seemed in a way to suggest that I was practicing all wrong with non-separation. I can think, oh, well, yeah, but I'm now practicing with non-separation from my father's absence, but it doesn't feel right. It doesn't seem to be right. There's this, you know, absence of the other. There's a sense of separation there. So I can practice with the sense of separation and non-separation from the separation, but it seems so intellectual, and, you know. But it's awakened me to seeing and experiencing this non-separation practice in a different way as well. How much time do I have? Am I done? Well, I just wondered what the time was.
Well, we say 20 to
we usually go about 8:45.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Great. There was so much I had in my mind that I wanted to share. Much of it about my father. The other thing my father's life has helped me realize is the great intimacy that does exist between self and other at a level that's really cellular and alive for me. Much of what I learned, many of these gestures and patterns of behavior and things that I do that remind me of my father were things that I didn't learn consciously from him. It's like I learned them through osmosis almost, just by standing near him. There was, in that and in the recognition that I have gestures, I make gestures like my father or sound like my father or look like my father, There is a recognition of the intimacy that we speak about in the Zen, it's just become very real to me, you know, in a very palpable, embodied way. This feeling that we're so this much the same. We're so alike, and my father's death and his life have awakened me to a sense of what it means for this Zen intimacy, this Buddhist idea of intimacy to exist between self and other. Because I don't feel like this is just me, you know, and a lot of what I do and say and think and feel reminds me of my father. I'm more like my father in feeling, in an existential sense, than I am like John, you know. So, I always think about the chant in the Heart Sutra when I think about death. Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha. Gone, it's translated in different ways, gone, gone beyond. Gone to the other shore, to where that shore is Bodhi, and Swaha is now. But gate means gone. Paragate can mean the other shore or carried away. Parasamgati, the sam and parasamgati means together. So you can translate it also as, you know, gone together to enlightenment now. And I often think of death as being that kind of going, being gone, going to the other side, to the other shore. I also think of the last words of the Buddha in the Parinirvana Sutta that Mio referenced last week. The Buddha said, when asked if he had any teaching for his disciples, for the monks, work out your salvation with, he said, things decay, so work out your salvation with great care. It kind of has a Christian overtone that to translate that way, it was salvation. And once I mentioned that translation to Mio, and he objected to it, I think he thought there was some better way to translate it. And there is. You can translate it as things are of a compound nature, so practice diligently, you know, and realizing your real life, your true life. It's interesting that he didn't say, the historical Buddha didn't say anything more or give the disciples much more information or suggest that they live their lives in any other way. And, you know, things do decay. A father dies, a brother, a mother, a good friend of the Sangha, we decay. And to work out our business here with great care is a real kind of call to action and a practice that's lifelong. It just goes on and on and never seems to finish, right? And the word care is interesting. I think that in Sanskrit or Pali, it's amapada, I think. And it's often translated as care, which can mean many different things. But it for me, you know, calls to mind the attention and given to the world around me, and the practice of paying heed. And I think amapada means, can also be translated as, if you take away the A, which means effectively not, it would mean heedlessness. So it's living in a way that is not heedless, or drunken, or careless, or driven by, you know, just doing whatever comes up in the moment and not paying any mind to what's happening around you. And I think, you know, the reflecting on my father's death, that comes up. And it reminds me that that's the way I want to live, with care, not being kind of drunken and careless or heedless in the way that I live moment by moment or day by day. And I don't know what happens, you know, to consciousness when it's all over. All I know is that right now, it is a very helpful way to live in the world, and to be not separate from the other, you know. My father wrote in the book that I put together for him, the Homer, my father's Odyssey, I asked him to inscribe it for me, and he did, and it said simply, thank you. Yeah, it's been good to know you. So there's one other thing that I wanted to share. I realize this is a little disjointed, but I worked for the Strand Bookstore in New York City at 14th and Broadway for a number of years, and I would buy books. I mean, all my money went into books. And my attitude was, you know, if your room wasn't cluttered with books, there was no hope, right? The more books cluttering your floor, the greater the hope. And I would buy these great collections of things, rarities for my father, like a, anyway. One of the books that I bought for him was this one, At the Foot of the Tree, A Wanderer's Musings Before the Fall by Rolf Edberg, a really great early environmentalist and statesman. And I bought it for my father because he had given me a copy and I think I lost it. So I bought another copy for him and I gave it to him and I inscribed it. This was in 1975. I wrote, and your insight tells you of dissolution, but not of corruption, of decomposition, but not of annihilation. Ellipses, continued wandering. So this is a quote from the book, right? Your insight tells you of dissolution, but not of corruption, of decomposition, but not of annihilation. Continued wandering. John, 1975, NYC. And below it, my father wrote, let me die with dignity, with my humanity intact. Thomas Edison Work, 1975, New York City. This, I was sleeping on the floor of my father's study after his death, and on my back looking up at the bookshelf upside down, and I saw this book, and I pulled it out and opened it up, and I had never known that he had added his own quotation from the book to my quotation. Let me die with dignity, with my humanity intact. And he did. You know, I think he did die with his humanity intact. He was very much loved. When I was 15, I decided to give away all my belongings and hitchhike across the country. And my father said, great. And I'll drive you to the edge of the city. So he drove me to the outskirts of Detroit, gave me $90, and I hitchhiked off across the country. You know, he was just that kind of person. And I always thought that he was very supportive of me specifically because he loved me. I'm his oldest son. And I have six younger brothers and sisters. And I felt very close to him, and we were close. But since his death, I've realized that he was that way with everybody. He supported everybody in that same kind of non-judgmental, really generous way, whatever they needed. And everybody had similar stories about my dad helping them become who they were becoming, you know. He didn't stand in anyone's way. He was really encouraging. He was an editor of a newspaper. He was actually a deputy managing editor for the New York Times. He was the night managing editor for a number of years. When Nixon resigned, the newspaper had this big headline that said, Nixon resigns. That was my father who designed that front page. And he did it consciously mimicking War Ends, that headline that was in the New York Times at the end of World War II. He thought this news is as big as that, so he, you know. And I became a journalist, largely, because of him and because I dropped out of school in ninth grade and I couldn't know anything else. And I grew up around newspapers and I was comfortable around newspapers. So I got a job in one and that led to a career. Again, you know, my father's influence, right? Let me die with dignity, with my humanity intact. A wish in 1975 really came true, you know. He was, for him. So I guess that's it. I don't really have an ending for this talk. Oh, I do. Wait, but it was supposed to be the beginning. My wife and I were lying in bed after my father's death, and I came back to Sacramento, and we were talking about his death. I had I took care of the funeral arrangements and the cremation. My stepmother and brother, who were there for my father's final hours and that struggle when he kept getting up and they kept trying to keep him in bed. They didn't want to see him, so, and I did. So the funeral home in Las Cruces, the funeral home director created a viewing for me. You know, my father was brought in on this gurney and draped in red, a red velvety kind of thing. And there was room for about 100 people in this viewing room, but there was only me and my dad. And I just sat there for a long time. I took a copy of his book and some sage and placed them on his chest. And he looked very different. He looked like a Norse king, or, you know, he had this regal look that I'd never noticed before, you know, and he looked different. And then at one point, I leaned forward and pressed my forehead to his forehead, and, you know, mine was very, very warm, and his was like frosted marble. It was really cold. And then I asked if I could accompany him to the crematorium. It's allowed under New Mexican law. You can have a witness to the cremation. So I accompanied my father's body to the crematorium and saw him into the oven. And then I was talking with my wife about this, and we were laying in bed when I got back home, and she said, it's a word I always, hold on, I have it here somewhere. These are the phrases that occurred to her. The irrevocable nothingness of death's face. The irrevocable nothingness of death's face. Which perfectly describes what I was trying to describe for her when I was looking at my father, you know. There's something truly irrevocable about death, and when the other is gone, and it's right there, you know, you can see it. But if death has an irrevocable face, I figure life does too. And the thing that occurred to me as I was preparing for this talk tonight about death, finally, in a word, I wanted to sum it up, and I thought, boundless, right? There's no boundary that I can think of to death. There are all kinds of boundaries in living, but death is boundless. I can't conceive of death. There's no way to kind of put an outline around it or say something about it that, you know, the experience of death, because I haven't had it, and no one in this room has, right? So I thought boundless is a good word for death, but then if death is boundless, life is boundless. And I have been thinking since that thought occurred to me that that's the way I really want to live. If I was going to reduce my Zen practice to one word, it would be boundless. Where are the definitions that we have to live a certain way, or be a certain way, or think a certain way, or feel a certain way? I mean, isn't Zen about great liberation, great freedom? And in that freedom, are there limitations or you know, places we shouldn't go, or is it boundless? I'm in favor of boundlessness. I say be boundless.
Translates Heart Sutra. Form is boundlessness.
Yeah.
Boundlessness is form.
That's it. It's a great freedom in that practice. Thank you. Thank you.